Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Hey, I'm excited. You got a paleontologist here.
Why are you stealing my joke? I set up that joke. I claimed that joke.
I waited in the bushes just to jump on it right there.
You know, where's my Indiana Jones whip? I thought aren't we remote from South Dakota looking for some dinosaur bones today?
We are. It's the only time I've ever heard.
Paleontology, I think.
Yeah, paleontology.
Wait, hold on. I misspelled the dang thing. It's not paleontology. What is it?
Paleontology.
It's not pain in my scientology. It's palliative care.
Yes, what the heck is that?
That's actually more scary than the dinosaur.
It's terrifying for people.
So identify your guest and he can explain.
So Michael, introduce yourself.
My name is Michael Demeritz, and I am the administrator for supportive care for a company called 247 Care at Home.
Can I just say, Paul, that's probably the quickest intro we've ever had on this show going to the guests.
We're
going to
be 20 minutes early today.
Usually they're sitting there going, why did I sign up for this? Are they going to introduce me?
Yeah.
You know, we're doing the warm-up routine usually, you know, before the main event.
That's
yes,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. That's by the way, that's Paul.
Okay. Good to meet you,
I'm
Paul.
The engineer and everyman. I get to periodically jump in his jokes, but most of the time I get to say, what the heck are you guys talking about? And palliative care is a term that I had never heard of until a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you had personal experience with it, Paul, but we had somebody here, I think maybe a month or so ago, we were talking about it a little bit.
Good friend of mine. I know who you had on. It's a friend of mine, Sherry Montgomery.
Yeah, exactly. I think we kind of just scratched the surface on it, and it wasn't her fault at all, but I walked out of there, you know, even more hesitant to talk about it or wanting to face it or deal with it. So I know there's a lot of confusion, right?
Absolutely. And I think that was why I was so excited to participate in this radio show of yours.
This rambling marathon.
He had a little tongue-in-cheek there when he said this radio show of yours. Okay, a little background for everybody who's listening, right? I've known Michael for a while now. So if you're getting a little sense of familiarity in his voice, I've known him. Okay, this is not just somebody I just met down in the lobby and said, hello, welcome, and good to have you on the show.
Pretty snarky for somebody.
We are Facebook friends.
Yeah, no,
yes.
Michael is snarky. In fact, I believe his middle name is Snarky.
It is.
And those in Tustin specifically know that
exactly,
he's snarky.
Exactly.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
But yeah, what is the confusion? I mean, there is confusion.
Well,
like hospice, palliative care.
One of the things that, and the, part of the reason why we're referring to it as the supportive care division, and
this
and
is why your company is supporting
it. My goal was really to make this available to the masses, because one of the things that everybody is aware of, and people in the healthcare field know, that hospice is a form of palliative care. Mm-hmm. However, whenever people are not yet ready for hospice, and you begin to talk to them about, you know what, I want to talk to you a little bit about palliative care. And that could be anybody that the family or the patient talks to. Could be a physician, could be a nurse. And one of the first things that almost every single one of them will say is, you know, it's just like hospice.
Yeah.
In introducing.
That's a conversation stopper.
It is.
And, la, la,
and,
la, la, la. Don't want to hear it.
Exactly.
And,
get behind me, Satan.
Good Catholic boy, by the way.
Yes. The population of patients that I particularly work with in the agency that I work is in a community where you don't bring up taboo subjects.
Yeah.
You have to be able
That's
to.
That's all we bring up on this show.
I kind of figured that out.
I think there were demonstrators downstairs.
I think there were. Get the show off the air.
But clearly, you know, in some languages, hospice doesn't translate into anything but hospice.
Mm, yeah.
And the word for a lot of people equates to death, because what happens to their family members is that they finally make the decision to go on hospice and die 24 hours later. That is a failure on our part in the healthcare community, is that when patients miss out on the true benefits of hospice because we're too quick to confirm with them that it's about death, Because it really isn't. Hospice is about quality of life.
Well, and I think we talked about it with Sherry when she was on here, is that, and I kind of was maybe showing off a little bit, my father is a history buff, and so I grew up very much with an ingrained interest in things like Knights Templar and Hospitallers,
yeah, right,
and you know, sort of Holy Land and Crusades, and plus they had good, nice little armor and swords, and you know.
That was, you were into that.
I didn't want to do the G.I. Joe thing. I wanted to do the, you know, the Crusader.
The Knights of Malta.
The Kingdom of God kind of stuff.
Right.
The origin of the word for hospice is actually a place of rest.
It is. It is. It's.
And you're right. It's kind of have been lost now to where it's a place of death.
Yes.
And you said something that really made me stop and think, because I immediately reacted negatively to it. You said hospice is not about death. And I went, no, it is. It's absolutely about death. It's the last God's waiting room. It's the last state. But you said it's about quality of life, and I thought, quality of life at that last stage. That's a whole different.
Well, we talk about dignity. I mean, Michael, give a little bit about your academic background, because I think it's important.
I have a master's degree in social work and a certification in gerontology. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the state of California.
And what are these other what are these other letters?
I'm a CCM, which is a certification for case management. I happen to be an elected commissioner for the Commission for Case Management.
You're on a few boards too, right?
And what's this other one? LCSW,
licensed clinical social worker.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought that maybe it was long.
He can help you, Paul.
Okay. Well,
I hope.
Even in this short period of time, I probably can't.
He's probably evaluated.
He already has.
He already has a prognosis. The reason why I suggested that you would share that with people is because we talk about social work. We talk about care. We talk about maintained care, and, you know, in case whether it's chronic or it's a long-standing issue, if maybe it's not an illness-based thing, but we talk about the sort of quality of life, the importance of quality of life. And somehow along the way, we forget, or maybe it's the disposable nature of our society, where people get to that point in life near the end where we now no longer refer to it about maintaining of a quality of life, regardless if the duration of that life is short.
Mm-hmm.
But the importance of that dignity as much as possible, the quality of life. And so all of a sudden, something that was supposed to be about quality of life and rest and respite and repose is become now about death. You might as well just put me in the corner of the room and watch me expire.
You know, one of the things that I've said to patients and families.
In people's minds, not necessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
put them somewhere to die.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because they come into hospice so late.
There you go.
It does actually happen 24, 48 hours a person dies.
Yeah.
My concern about that is that it is a benefit that the government has set up to be unlimited.
Right.
The initial benefit is a 6-month benefit, mm-hmm. but if you don't access it early, mm-hmm. you lose out on
it. So what do you think that is?
Wait till the last
minute. But I mean, you're not personally necessarily waiting. You're counting on people that are professionals and experts to guide you, right?
Well, I actually think that...
Or do they wait? Do they hesitate and say...
I think that... I wrote in the book that I published about 20 years ago that if you want an answer to a question from a physician, you have to ask the question, which means you have to be comfortable with asking the difficult question.
And the name of the book was?
Dying 101, okay. A short course on living for the terminally ill.
See, again, a living for the terminally ill. The idea that once you find out that you have a terminal illness, that you're going to die, we're all terminal in that sense. But when you get the knowledge that it's coming sooner rather than later, there is a point of having quality of life at that point.
You think it'll be too morbid if we start every show by just chanting the mantra, none of us will get out of here alive?
Yeah.
We
say it, but I mean, but what we're talking about here specifically, right, relevant to that is, and my question is, if I'm looking for that medical practitioner or that system to actually guide me to when I should exercise that, what you're saying is, you got to engage with that system and with that physician and ask the question and not just count on them to basically initiate it early?
You know, things are changing in this country because we actually do have some organizations that are really hell-bent on explaining what is palliative care and how that can be beneficial to you. Let me give you a brief kind of a definition of it. Palliative effective care is to be provided for someone who has a serious illness at any stage of that illness and at any age. There is no opting in for palliative care, or at least it shouldn't be an opt-in. You have to make a decision to go on hospice. You have to sign paperwork to go on hospice, because hospice is a benefit that well, for most people, is a hospitalization benefit that's being converted into hospice.
And do you have to qualify for it? Does
yes.
the physician have to say, yes, you have a terminal?
Well, not just one physician. Two physicians have to identify you as having 6 months or less to live.
Okay.
A lot of times that's very difficult for a physician to do. They
can imagine.
They say, I'm not God. I can't predict when you're going to die. One of the best questions to ask anybody is, would you be surprised if this person died within a year?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not surprised, they're appropriate for hospice.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not surprised, they're appropriate for what we're referring to as supportive care.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that period of time between now and when you think they might die, there's a horrendous amount of suffering that can occur. Horrendous.
Yeah.
People,
unbelievable amount that you can't even, pain and misery.
People are debating physician-assisted suicide today in the state of California
mm-hmm.
because of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
We have the ability, and I believe this in my heart, we have the ability to relieve the majority of suffering. The majority of suffering in this world, at that stage of life, mm-hmm. we can actually do something about.
How? Through drugs or through care? Or?
Well, through identification of the symptoms that are distressing to someone. So someone that is short of breath or pain is out of control, or they're extremely anxious, or there's anything that's troubling to them, if it's not addressed directly, they're going to suffer.
Mm. So let me pose a sort of a...
We've got to get Rod a little closer here. He doesn't.
You always wanted me to do this.
I want
right?
you to do the Barry White voice.
You always want me to do this.
Yeah.
Right?
I kind of feel like I'm on NPR.
It has that feel, doesn't it? All things considered.
We're not talking showers. We're not talking lighting candles. I'm not doing any Barry White for you today.
Okay.
But I may be completely wrong right here, but I'm hearing that palliative care is actually, just in terms of timeline or duration, could actually be quite a long period of time.
Absolutely. You could be diagnosed with cancer today and say, you know what, I want to have a palliative care specialist.
So would you say palliative is the attempt to reduce or remove suffering?
Absolutely. One of the things that I have been saying, I blog about this issue on a regular basis, and I've made a very consumer-focused definition of palliative care.
Okay.
Do you know what it is?
No.
Good medical care.
Mm.
And demand it. I want good medical care.
Yeah, you're just causing all kinds of ripples into the system doing that. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you know in other parts of the world, we don't ask people, would you like good medical care?
Yeah.
We just begin to provide it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the truth.
No, it's true.
Now, let me ask you the key question. I know something about this subject for two reasons. One, both my mother and father passed away after prolonged illnesses. My mother really suffered. She had Parkinson's disease and lots of other things, offshoots of that. And at the end, when she died, I remember good Catholics that we were, my dad and I and her sister went out in a room and, we're saying, let's say a prayer for Mom. And I looked at everybody and said, what are we praying for?
Mm-hmm.
Are we praying that this continues? Are we praying that the end to this? And so when she died, it really was a relief for everybody, her included, mm-hmm. to end that suffering. Now, my mother, prior to that, many years ago, for some reason, got into hospice as a volunteer. She
Ooh.
Discovered this, I think, through the church, and became passionate about it and worked for many years as a volunteer in hospice centers. And so I had a chance to hear about these things and see some of the amazing things. And she said something that stuck with me. She said, at that moment, when life is at its last stage, when you know there's a finite amount of time left, there is no time that is more important to have quality of life than those last couple. You don't want to spend the last few moments, days, weeks, months, years of your life getting choked up there,
mm-hmm.
Suffering.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I think is so important for people to understand is that the one thing, the most valuable thing that hospice gives and that palliative care can give you is time.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to say goodbye.
Yes.
It's time to say I love you. It's time to say you matter to me.
which is no small bit, but we take for granted. And then in moments like that, you realize...
Somebody says to you tomorrow that you've got 48 hours to live. What would you do? You have to put your affairs in order and everything. You want to go say goodbye. You want to see that last sunset. Whatever it is that's important to you, you want to do it. You don't want to be traumatized and miss those last... You only got 2 days left. Make the most of them.
And to be honest, who thinks that way, right? Nobody, right? So when you find yourself in that situation, the need for actually qualified help, mm-hmm. to guide you through that when time is very finite,
yes,
it's very, very important. And the reason why I asked the question that I did, you guys both know me long enough by now, but that I usually don't ask a question unless I sort of have a feeling what the answer is going to be, mm-hmm. is because I think part for the confusion, for me at least, was that I equated the time duration. And let's face it, medical practice the way it is today, I'm going to get you in the last minute. I'm going to get you out in the quickest time because you're covered by insurance, whatever, right?
It's not really,
to Michael, to your point, it's not like there's a lot of the world, or old school, if you will, where you just take care of people that need care.
Right.
Okay, it's predicated on all these other things that you need to qualify for, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's a reality to that that people don't realize. I don't know what the statistic is, Michael probably does, but the amount of money that you're going to spend in your life on medical care is so weighted towards the end. It's like 90-95% in those last few years. So whatever you do in your life, most of that money is going to be spent.
You know what, Paul? I'm sorry. There's a certain anger that I have when it comes to the medical system in this. I'm not saying it shouldn't be about money. Okay. Everything has a reality. But when I have time, okay, when I have time to maybe do that elective procedure of putting a crown in my mouth or God knows what, ACL replacement or whatever, right? Fine, then put me through whatever. But when I have a finite amount of time, and when I'm basically elderly, and in particularly, I have fallen, right?
Right.
And I have injured myself. When you can't get me out of the hospital fast enough and as a discharge, okay, that just irks me to no end.
Or how about can't get you into the hospital like the VA was going through?
Oh, my God.
See a doctor. In the meantime, I'm dying. And they're like, in a certain sense, they're going, oh, thank God they died. We didn't have to do all this stuff.
And we talk about it all the time here, is that with all of that being the conditions as it is today, given the actual demographics and population we're talking about, we are so unready for this.
Well, let me tell you something. This patient population is not going to be in the hospital.
Okay.
They're going to be diverted. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be taking up space in hospitals because it's not the most appropriate place for them to be.
Where will they be diverted to?
I'm not quite sure exactly. I've given the term a super SNF, a super skilled nursing facility.
Okay.
SNF is what we refer to in the vernacular. Okay. But a super SNF that patients with, serious illness who have, distressing symptoms and they're just a problem, they're going to be diverted from the traditional emergency room to something like that where they're going to get attended to and then sent home quickly. Because home is where people really want to be. Very seriously ill people can be managed at home without any difficulty.
Well, and we I think it was one or two shows ago, we had a lady who is the current chair for the National Aging in Place Council, mm-hmm. in Orange County. And I'm a certified aging in place.
Yes.
So we advocate all the time that for all kinds of reasons, financial all the way through to just healthy recovery, mm-hmm. okay, in a familiar environment, that whenever possible to care for a person in whatever condition, if it is possible to do in a familiar environment of their own home, that it's better to do that than putting them into a medical situation. Now, it's not the case every single time that you can actually accomplish this, mm-hmm. but I think there's a lot of situations where we could do that, but because of the system the way it is, it doesn't actually account for that as an option.
And the incentives are there to keep them in the hospital.
Right.
What happens is that if you're sick, if you're very seriously ill, it doesn't matter who you are, if you have an incident occur that you think, oh God, I need to talk to the doctor, need to get a hold of somebody, it's 5 after 5.
Right.
The message that you'll receive is, if this is a life-threatening emergency, go to the nearest emergency room.
Which fewer and fewer of them are, by the way, around.
And that's where you're going to go. Even if you get a hold of somebody, they'll say, well, gosh, it's really so late in the day. Just go to the emergency room.
Right.
And that is the
worst.
Or
urgent care now.
That is the worse place for people to go. They'll get their needs met, certainly. But for somebody who is very frail and there's a lot going on with them, for them to go to the emergency room may not necessarily be the best place for them to stay and get their needs met quickly.
You hear it all the time, right? Yeah. People check in for something that has nothing to do with it, and then the next thing you know, they've got contracted some sort of pneumonia.
Oh, it's just horrible. And I think that one of the guideposts that you can see is that the changes in the number of beds in the hospitals as they're being reconstructed because of the earthquake retrofitting, we're noticing that the numbers of beds are being decreased. Why in God's name would we be doing that with 80 million baby boomers?
I usually don't get engaged into sort of local politics or whatever on this show, but I will tell you, we have a situation in San Clemente right now where I live, where the hospital that started out as San Clemente Hospital then was bought, and I will save from mentioning names, but bought by a conglomerate that owns hospitals in that part of the county. They're looking to close it down, turn it into more non-emergency situation. Okay, my parents live in San Clemente. Okay, if I do the math, simple math, if they were basically in a condition where they had to be taken to an emergency hospital,
they're 30 minutes away.
They're 45 minutes away, which is borderline what legally they are able to. But and now we're talking about, well, but it's exactly within 45 minutes. And I'm thinking, I don't give a crap. If I can get them into it in 10 minutes, that's where I want them to go. So you're eliminating something,
but
and you're telling me that
money.
The numbers work, that you know most urgent care can still be delivered within 45 minutes. It's like, we got a location.
Yeah.
Closing it down, turning it into a physician's offices, and basically, so now the discussion, it's like they went down this path of this is the way it's going to be. Now the discussion at the state level is, well, maybe we have these freestanding emergency rooms.
Right.
And to your point, those emergency rooms have no beds.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what, now it's an in
and
out.
I'm going to ask Michael a tough question here. Of all the services the hospitals provide, what's the least profitable part of it? I got to believe it's emergency rooms.
Oh, God, I haven't worked in hospitals in some time and never really in that kind of area.
Interesting to find out, because I don't think it's a profit center for them. I think it's a way to bring people. You come to the hospital, and then hopefully they'll admit you. And
well, one of the things that happens is that they don't necessarily get to decide who they treat. So they have to take everybody. And so a lot of times people come in without insurance. They come in, they're not documented. There's whatever is going on, and the hospital has no recourse. There's a whole concept of safety net hospitals that we have to be really cognizant of in terms of how do we take care of
hospitals
our communities.
Like any business, are trying to find the high profit services. And my father did some consulting years ago. He was a management consultant after he retired, and for a hospital chain in Michigan. And I don't remember what it was, but it ain't the emergency. There's other things they get far more money from. And they're always trying to expand. They're always trying to get these million-dollar machines and then profit. And all that's good. We need that kind of stuff. But the hospitals, I don't understand why we got away from the idea of hospitals as a service and turned it into a profit-making business, particularly because most of the, or I don't know what the percentage is, but it seems like half or more of these hospitals are owned by not-for-profit corporations.
Well, now you're delving into other layers of this. Right?
I mean, I'm a Catholic, so all these Catholic nuns founded all these hospitals, and through the years, they've all been bought out, the St. Joseph's, the St. this, the St. stuff. They've all been bought out by some corporation, and the nuns aren't even allowed to walk around anymore and provide the palliative care that you talk about, the hand-holding. And I know this for a fact in Detroit, where my father did some of this consulting. There was a hospital called St. Joseph's out in suburban Detroit, founded by the nuns, I think the nuns of St. Joseph, and they still live there. Somebody bought them. The nuns are still allowed to live somewhere, and they're all like in their 80s, and they had nothing to do because they would not let them walk around. And my father was saying, why don't you let them at least walk around emergency care where people are frantic? Most people respond when they see a priest or a nun or a minister or somebody walk in some sort of religious garb. Immediately you're drawn to
them. Okay, so what we're saying is what started out to be a provision of care and solace for people that happened to then have a medical component to it.
They weren't doing it to make money. They were doing it to take care of people.
Let's face it. You were doing it so that you could guarantee yourself an entrance into heaven.
I mean, well, okay,
let's get really...
They felt called to... A lot of these religious orders felt called to do this. It was part of their... how they were going to help people. It's the nature of like Mother Teresa walking the streets of India and picking up dead and dying people. She didn't do it to make money. She didn't do it to turn it into a business here. And from that were born quite a lot of hospitals. And then those hospitals grew and turned into profit-making centers, even though they're still ostensibly not for profit. They're run as if they're profit-making machines.
So there is this, obviously, from what we're talking about, a need to put the humanity component back into it in terms of support.
Amen.
Emotional or otherwise, right? And I think what we don't realize also here is that the diversity of backgrounds, cultures, minorities, all of that stuff factors in as well, because when you get to that point in your life, and there's a book I need to share with you, Michael, that somebody wrote that was actually a victim's advocate, but they wrote this book about where care, but in the fact that you need to be acutely aware, the person that you are delivering the care to may have certain things within their culture, their background, about whether it's physical touch, physical space, eating habits, nutritional stuff, that you also, you can't, it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very critical time of somebody's life. So it sounds like within the case of your company, I think it's a great move that you've moved it to what it is, which is its support.
Right. One of the things that we refer to is the medically underserved. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're poor people. Medically underserved means that they are lacking access because of cultural or linguistic barriers.
Mm.
Using the language that we're using for white folks like myself is not necessarily helpful to people who may have a different language or come from a different culture that things mean different things to them.
It's like the criticism every year of the SAT scores, and they wonder why minorities score less. How many polo ponies does it take to, you know, they phrase these questions in such a way that they're going to go, I don't know what the heck they're talking about here. They don't use common terms. And I certainly
had two in my own backyard when I was growing up, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
Right.
So the same thing, it holds true when you go into a hospital. I've been in the hospital now with my dad, my mom, and my 90-year-old aunt. I counted it over 18 times the three of them have been in the hospital for emergency procedure, an operation, or something here. I've become somewhat of an expert going in and being that advocate for an aging person. And the first thing you have to do is understand the mumbo jumbo.
So how do you turn something that nobody wants to talk about, physicians or otherwise, that nobody really prepares you for, that is as much part of life as being born,
right,
to where it becomes a time of empowerment, a time of focusing on what it is.
That you only have so much time left, you want to make it count.
Absolutely. I think that it really comes down to having some acknowledgement of what's happening, being able to say to anybody, you are very seriously ill right now. There's a lot going on. And it is serious. And so we're going to do something special for you. We're going to add care and add services that can be provided in your home, add treatment, add whatever it is, so that we can address this need in anticipation of a decline.
Okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate, Michael. I'm sitting here. I'm looking, and Paul is motioning to me that we're coming up on a break. We can either address this now or after the break. I'm sitting here. I'm looking at my bank account. I'm looking at the family's assets. I've got a parent that's basically old and in that condition that you described. And now we're having to make a decision, right? There really isn't necessarily, as far as I know, at this moment when I'm making a decision, I don't know whether there's any of my insurance will cover. I don't know what resources I have available. All I'm seeing is I'm going to write a check out of this thing to do this, right?
And I don't know where to go.
And I'm feeling guilty if I'm evaluating it on any kind of monetary level, because that's apparent that I shouldn't even be evaluating that in. But I'm also looking at, I don't know how long, I don't know all of this stuff, right? So I'm completely overwhelmed.
What are my choices, everything else?
You know, it is a long answer, and so we may want to wait until afterwards.
Let's do that. Think about it. Let's come back and do a break.
Because I think it's very common for somebody in that moment to find themselves in that.
I was there. And I'm telling you, it's something that none of us are prepared for, and you don't know where to turn to, and guilt comes into it because you're about, just like you said, you're thinking about how much money have we got to support mom and dad, and I'm trying to think, will it last? And
this is where you turn to, this show.
Yes.
To find those answers. We'll be right back.
If you are like the majority of Americans, you want to continue living in a familiar environment throughout your maturing years. In fact, according to many surveys, 82% of homeowners overwhelmingly prefer to age in place, which means living in their current homes safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age or ability level. With over 30 years of combined experience in residential, commercial, hospitality, and destination resorts fields, your home for a lifetime is a company dedicated to empowering you to maintain your quality of life and independence by helping you make your house your home for a lifetime. Do you want to reorganize or remodel your home? Do you want to add a full bathroom and possibly a bedroom on the main floor? Are you looking to make your kitchen more functional? Is an aging parent moving in, or your child is moving out, or even moving back in? Call Your Home for a Lifetime at 949-492-1872 or check them out on the web at yourhomeforalifetime.com and find out how they can help you make your house your home for a lifetime.
Okay. All right. We dropped a big question,
and I'll just rephrase it very quickly. Basically, we're talking to Michael Demeritz.
With 24/7
Care. 24/7 Care. Thank you.
At-home supportive care.
Michael is a buddy of mine, and I've known him for a long time, and I really have always been impressed by his integrity and his... I'm flipping through the pages of his book. That's what you're hearing.
That's the sound.
But the integrity... Well, you know, I told you, I needed like some kind of gaffer, somebody, you know, to make noises for me. Where's the shoes on
sound
the
effects.
Step or something?
We'll get a sound effects guy.
But Michael has always struck me as a person, and I've known him long enough to know that it's not all visuals. Michael is truly very much full of integrity and a lot of professionalism, and he has a big heart. Can I call it a calling? It's a calling, I think, Michael.
I think it's an avocation, much like the priesthood.
That's why a lot of religious orders were drawn to this, because it's a need
it's a
to
natural.
Help people.
He does have a little piousness about him, doesn't he? Think?
Well, he's got that bald spot on the top. Right?
Okay, too much. Too soon, Paul. But no, I mean, I've known him for a number of years, and you've been with a number of different companies, and you've gone off and done different things, but they're pretty much the common thread has been always this sort of sense of really care and putting yourself out there to provide that, because there's definitely a lack of it. And the question we ended the first part of the show with before the break was, okay, we're talking about the tough stuff, right? We don't shy away from it in the show. We're talking about palliative care, and we're talking about how it's different from hospice, and we touched on that at the beginning of the show. I'll sum it up maybe at the end. But basically,
what happens when you're in the situation that Rod laid out here?
Right, that I'm basically facing a parent, a spouse, whatever, in their last days.
Mm-hmm.
I am sitting there completely aghast, not knowing what to do. I've got a professional in front of me or somebody who's supposed to maybe guide me. And the first things that are going to come out of their mouths are going to really determine the foundations of what we do, the relationship that we're about to establish that is driven to provide care. And all I can think of is, how much is this going to cost me? And, oh, my God, I feel so guilty about even thinking about it in terms of
right,
money.
Right. Yes.
So what do you say?
Well, the first thing I want, and I'll fill in the gaps on some of this in a little bit, but the first thing that I want to say is that if you have someone who's in front of you who is willing to be honest and authentic with you about what's going on and saying, your mom meets criteria for hospice, which says that she has about 6 months. If I said it in a different way, mm-hmm. Rod, I think we're talking weeks, mm-hmm. not months. Mm-hmm. If I said it that way, you would make a very different decision about how you would approach this.
Well, because the reality of the situation is unavoidable.
Right. And you also would calculate financially mm-hmm. that it might be doable rather than nebulous and saying, oh, this is an unlimited amount of money that I'm going to be spending.
Look, I can't put myself in different people's shoes, but I will say this. If it comes down to it, at the end of the day, if you can do it financially or mm-hmm. whatever, it's an issue of priorities. And right now, at that moment in time, I don't know what other priorities I would have.
But you want to make sure, as the good son, it's not going to run out. And if I do this too soon, the money's going to run out. And then what? Now it gets even worse. Now mom's still dying, and I got to take her home or put her in the street or whatever. Well,
and you speak from a position of somebody who's gone through this personally.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you know. Right. Go ahead, Michael.
There's two ways of looking at it. Is that what are your physical resources? Your personal physical resources.
Yeah.
Can you physically do it yourself?
Yeah.
Do you have family members that could do it themselves?
Take it on.
Take it on. Take on the responsibility. And we're talking about the personal care, the stuff that's not paid for by Medicare or private insurance.
Describe for people what that's like. Like, what is involved?
There's a lot of different payers that pay for different things. But for the most part, and I'll just go with the easiest, is that hospice is a service that is paid for by Medicare, Medi-Cal, Medicaid, and private insurance. And it is paid for by all those entities because it's less expensive care, but it is quality care. Mm-hmm. What's involved in the care is a nurse that visits you, a home health aide that visits you for bathing, perhaps a physician visit or two, a social worker, chaplain, volunteers, a number of individuals. You get a grand parade of people, all of it paid for by Medicare or your insurance.
And this is at your house?
And that will be done at your home or a place that you call home, which could be a skilled nursing facility, a residential board and care facility, you know, independent living or an apartment, wherever you live that you call it home.
And the frequency of that kind of service is dependent on each case?
It's dependent upon your need.
Okay.
Is that different if you go into an actual hospice center?
Well, there are not a lot of those places.
Yeah.
Typically, if you go into a place that's called hospice, frequently that is an inpatient environment where you have to meet very strict criteria.
Okay.
And that's different in different parts of the country and based upon the organization.
That's where my mother volunteered at a place in Michigan, a hospice center.
Yeah. And we don't have a whole lot of those kind of environments in Southern California because it's very expensive to have that kind of a property.
That it isn't a good idea. It's just too expensive to buy the land and have the building.
Yeah. And also, it can be done in a small board and care facility, six-bed residential facility. So I don't know that we necessarily have a gigantic need for it. We have wonderful people who do this work. And I speak for people who are involved in hospice that they're just awesome folks.
Right.
You know, years ago, whenever I was at a hospital and we referred to lots of different hospice programs, one of the things that if a family chose one that I might not choose, I'd say, you're going to find an awesome nurse. You're going to have an awesome social worker. You're going to have awesome people that work with you, your family member.
Let me just stop that. So if you qualify for hospice, you have to have two physicians say that you have 6 months or less to live.
Mm-hmm.
And then they set out a plan for you of how often and how frequently and who visits you.
Correct.
And where. Now, that's all paid for. Except for what?
Say if you needed to have a caregiver to stay with you for large amounts of time, 4 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours, all day, all night, whatever it was, that's usually out of pocket. That's where I was going with the comment first when Rod, you said, well, I'm going to have to write checks or I'm going to have to do something financially, and oh gosh, I'm thinking about this way. Well, if I told you it's going to be a month, you've got that. I've seen your car.
Yeah,
I know you could do it.
Yeah. No,
but if it could go on for years,
it's more the unknown, really, that scares the living Jesus out of people.
And that's why I said earlier is that you need to ask a physician that you trust the direct question: Am I dying? How much time do I have? Be as honest as you can in terms of what you estimate my time is my family.
And will they tell you?
And to that point, though, I was just flipping through Michael's book. The book title is Dying 101, A Short Course on Living for the Terminally Ill. Now, I understand it's out of print.
That is correct.
But that there are copies. You can find it. You search on Amazon or somewhere you'll find it. Right in the beginning, which is interesting what you just said, because the format of the book is more of a dialogue,
is a conversation.
Which is actually a conversation. Yeah. Right?
My co-authors and I did I think it was an awesome book, and it could be reprinted without changing a whole lot and still have the same impact.
We might have to talk to him about that.
Yeah. Maybe we have the publishing wing of the show or something.
Maybe so. Maybe we just expanded this. You know, I don't have a lot of time, Paul. The question that is being asked here, it says there's a conversation between Mrs. D, B, and Mrs. D, and Ms. B says, dying, why would anyone want to read about that?
Yeah.
And Ms. D says, it's not really about dying, but more about how you'd spend the rest of your life.
Particularly when the rest of your life has a finite amount of time left.
Now, I don't know what Mrs. B then means by as a reaction to that, but the point is made that it really is like we've been talking about. It's about quality of life regardless of the duration that you may have for that quality
and the
of
point
life.
I was
the, importance
trying to,
of that.
The point I was trying to make is that I've seen it now up close. When you realize that you really do only have a finite amount of time left and somebody tells you 6 months or less or weeks left to live, there is nothing more important than the quality of that time.
Mm-hmm. Can I tell you something? When I was 20, back in the old days.
When I was 17, or whatever. When I was 21.
Yeah, it's your generation, not mine. When I was 20, you're right, I was younger.
See?
You're right, I was younger. I was at college, and I don't know what caused me to do this. I had grandparents. I had all my grandparents. Everybody was still alive and all this stuff. And there was something inside me that realized that I'm going to be facing something that I was completely unprepared for. Somewhere along the way.
Like a sense, or something?
Yeah, yeah. I took a class on death and dying in college.
Oh, that's weird.
And there was a consciousness. Yeah, I'm morbid that way. There was a consciousness. Who knew that I would be doing this show years later? I was instinctively preparing myself by looking into that. And, you know, the course basically talked about the stages of grief and things of that nature, right? And the anger and finally, you know, the resolution coming to terms with things. But none of us consciously even prepare ourselves to that degree. So when we find ourselves with aging parents and stuff like that, it's why important, you know, I wanted you to come in here and I wanted you to differentiate palliative care from hospice. The questions we're talking about cover hospice. Now, if I was going to do palliative care, there's the same resources available for palliative care?
Unfortunately, not in every setting. A lot of times it depends on, you know, who's paying the bills, and it depends on how the organization that's providing palliative or supportive care is set up. So I'll share with you how we're doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
24/7 care at home, the supportive care division, is actually doing it through home health.
Okay.
And home health, you have to meet criteria for a skilled need. You have to need skilled care in some fashion. So pain out of control, you have shortness of breath, you've got other issues that need to be addressed in the home environment, wound care, things of that nature. And so what we will do is we will provide a nurse, a social worker, there will be a physician that will visit. Certainly under the home health benefit through Medicare, there are things that are available as to what the patient needs. And it can go on as long as the person meets criteria.
Right.
The difference between that and hospice is that hospice is a package that you get everything, and the visits are based upon your need, not necessarily on the limitations that are put forth.
There's a timetable on hospice where there isn't palliative care.
You might need
wound care for longer than 6 months.
Yeah, and you don't need to opt in. You don't have to sign off and say that I'm going to be on this service. My personal feeling is that palliative care is really a lot about conversation, a lot about communication, a lot about addressing the psychosocial issues, that the things that people are thinking about in the middle of the night when they can't sleep, the stuff that they need to do in terms of advanced care planning, all of those things that are so important, getting your affairs in order. We are a procrastinating society. By nature. And so having the knowledge...
Rod and I are looking at each other and nodding.
Yeah, yeah. Having the knowledge that you've got something serious going on, that you need to attend to certain things, is extremely important. And so that's why we've kind of laden the program a little bit more with social work, because I'm a social worker.
But I totally see the fit for it.
But I believe that it's really about the psychosocial needs of the client and the family.
Because that was something I wasn't prepared for.
What's that?
The psychosocial thing. I'll give you some tangible examples. My father, big, tough, rough guy, corporate executive. He's falling a lot, so he's going in and out of skilled nursing. This is a guy who I used to kid and say he could stop breathing if he wanted to. He had such self-control. You know, I can do anything. And all of a sudden, I'm not getting out of this, am I? I'm scared. This is the end, isn't it? Well, it did turn out to be the end, but a lot longer than he was anticipating. So his fear, I'm not getting out of here. And his fears became worse at night when nobody was there, when the place shut down. Oh, my God, I'd get these calls at 3 in the morning. He's having panic attacks, and he's crying, and he's upset. My father is having panic attacks. My father is crying at 3 in the morning. Get down here. I've got to sit with him all night long because he's like a little kid. He's scared of the dark.
You know what's funny, Paul? It's not funny. But in that same story that you just said, it's not just your father, from where I'm sitting.
Right.
It's not just your father that needs the support. It's also you. Because
I wasn't ready for this.
Are you ready to see your father in that light, or to transition him, because you've held him so high on a pedestal, you know, and in such high regard, that now you're having to face the reality and the humanity of your father? I think that's another thing. It's why when I saw this, Michael, to be honest, and I saw, you know, you guys talk about, I mean, it's in the description, you know, we are here to serve you, and you guys talk about, you know, provide and deliver cost-effective medical services, which I thought was interesting as starting off right there, because it's the first thing in people's mind, right? Medical equals cost, dollar signs, right? And then the highest quality with specific expertise in home health care. The word care is more than medical.
Yes.
And that social work component of it, which you know, my brother-in-law just graduated from Long Beach. My wife, you know, is a counselor, specializes in college students. Social work is such a critical element. And yet it's sort of like that middle management thing that happens, you know. It doesn't really you guys really don't get your credit you're due. Oh, honest to God. I mean, you're shaking your head like, yeah.
The social worker at these at these rehab centers or nursing homes or whatever you call it, where you go after the hospital kicks you out to somehow recover or whatever it is. Their social worker comes in, and it's all paperwork, and it's all, well, you've only got 3 weeks left on Medicare. They got to get out of here in 3 weeks, and so you got to come up with something. And here's some options, and here's the cost, and everything. It's like, whoa, how are we going to handle this? Yeah, how are we going to deal with it?
Their role in that environment is more case management, and more of a function of for the hospital in terms of moving people in, moving people out. Really, being able to address the human side of care is something that is sometimes lost in some programs. But the reality is that most social workers with master's level training are going to be able to intervene. Spiritual support people are just awesome. I mean, I can't say enough for chaplains who literally can see people suffering.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I find myself as a therapist a vessel to capture and to hear these stories and to hear this and to retain this information and feed it back to people in a way that makes it not so harsh. We have to be witnesses to this suffering so that we can stop it.
Absolutely. And you, I mean, I'm looking at you and I can see how deeply you feel about this because not only is it genuine in your case, but I think it's so critical. I mean, I have nothing but the utmost regard for social workers, honestly. And it could be anything from, you know, at-risk children to elderly across the board. It is such a part of care. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's that human side of care that doesn't really get a lot of time. A lot of camera time, if you will, right? Yeah. But it is so critical. In order for somebody to recover, right, it's more than just passing my next physical exam or my blood count or, you know, whatever. There's all this emotional aspect of it that we don't usually cover.
And if nobody has ever been to a nursing home or a rehabilitation center, whatever, where the hospital sends you after they discharge, they only hold you for a little while. It used to be the hospital took care of you. Now they kick you out to some other facility. And I'm telling you, when you walk up and down, some people are there that are younger and they're recovering from a knee operation. Okay, they're there to get physical therapy and some other thing. Other people are there because they don't know where to put them next and they're probably going to die. And you only have a month there to try and get better. And if you don't show some improvement, you get kicked out.
Right.
And then there are other people in the nursing home part of it that are paying an exorbitant amount of money to sit there forever until they die. And these people are wailing all throughout the night. They're screaming, help me, help. The guy next to my dad all night long for 24 hours a day, help me, help me, help me. This is all I hear when I walk in the facility. Somebody else is walking up and down the hallway out of their mind. Somebody else is babbling in the room next to him. It's like an insane asylum. It's like some Dickens novel here. And you walk into this thing, and I'm supposed to recover and feel better.
Look, I don't want to pick on the medical profession per se, okay?
They're awful, most of them.
Okay. There you go.
They're awful.
One of the things, if I can interject here and bring us back to the topic.
Yeah. we tend to meander over here.
It's okay. I'm gonna start a crusade against these places.
We talk about cost-effective care.
Yeah.
I want you to – do you know what it costs for a 4 or 5 day stay in a hospital?
Tell me.
In Orange County, on average, is about $15,000.
Yep.
Okay. Now, on
four or five days.
On average, mm-hmm. what does it cost for 1 day of hospice care?
Just
1 day.
What does it cost?
In Orange County, I think it's $185 a day. And that is the responsibility of the hospice program to manage that money and provide the services. And either they make a profit or they don't. But the reality is that they get that per diem every day that they're providing care.
Say that again. So you're saying if I go into the hospital and I sit there for 4 days, somebody's got to pay $15,000.
On average. It could be a lot more.
Instead, if I go $15,000, instead if I go release from there and go into a hospice environment where somebody's...
Or a situation where you're covered under hospice and you're provided that care at
home.
Now
it's $800. For those 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, it's much less. It's much less.
So why isn't everybody pushing it? I thought that was part of the Obamacare initiative, was to try and get people into their homes more and to find ways to fund and support.
There's some very subtle ways that that's being done. there was some things that came across the Newswire recently about the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services providing money for physicians to provide end-of-life counseling and end-of-life conversations and helping people to do advanced care planning. I personally think that it's really very difficult to expect a physician to do that.
I agree.
I think nurse practitioners, social workers, people that are maybe not as rushed can actually sit down and have a conversation that's going to be longer than 15 minutes.
Yeah, especially when physicians have been conditioned now to basically, here's your schedule, and I'm going to fit as many people as I can into your examination room.
And I'm going to tell you from two experiences, no, three with my aging aunt, not one of the doctors that saw any of them through the years in these 18 visits, particularly the multiple visits from my mother and father towards the end, not one of the doctors ever sat down and talked to my mother or father and said, this is like coming to the end here. This is what you're going to face. This is what you're going to see. None of them had that conversation.
That's what Michael was talking about. Yeah. I mean, establishing that honest, reality-based relationship with somebody and telling you the hard thing you don't want to hear. How are you going to basically handle that quality of life?
You know, in the book, and not to promote the book's out of print, but the reality is that I say very, very specifically that if you want an answer, you got to ask the question, because the physician isn't going to be going down that path because they don't know what's at the end of that path.
Right.
It could be a very emotional experience. It could take an awful lot of time. Mm-hmm. It could become really challenging because you might not be able to get out of that situation and have to be able to call somebody else in to help.
Yeah.
Okay. So the doctors avoid it.
But let's just call it like it is, right? Yeah. I mean, that doctor, to be fair, does not have the training, nor the expertise. I mean, Michael, would you just tell everybody that's listening what is entailed in somebody getting a master's in social work? I mean, how many hours do you have to put in?
Oh, God. Oh, my God. I just told this to my nursing staff who I wanted them to understand, you know what? I have a four-year degree in some degree. It was actually happened to be in psychology.
Right.
Then I got two more years trained as a master's level social worker.
Right.
In that training, we are in field work where you are actually working for nothing.
Yes.
In a hospital or skilled nursing facility or some other environment where I spent on average 3 days, 24 hours a week. That was my requirement to pass to get my master's degree. Then to get a license, it was 2.5 years of supervised work under another licensed social worker.
Wow.
And so here I am, you know, 9 years later, able to practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I always want people to understand is that social workers, you know, we don't just hand out welfare or take away children from their parents because of things of, you know, things are going south. Certainly we're capable of doing that in a very kind way, but the truth of the matter is that we're highly trained,
mm-hmm.
and we are expecting a physician to do something similar. I don't think that's possible.
Most people on the planet basically are conflict averse. Okay, they'll run in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
In your capacity as a social worker, you're faced with stuff that's coming to you that you not only have to compartmentalize correctly, address, but then also the following one may have completely different realities to the one you just handled.
Absolutely.
So when we're talking about 9 years of that kind of exposure, to be fair to physicians, how are you supposed to be prepared to deal with stuff that is emotional and end-of-life situation?
I don't want to let the physicians off the hook because they really do run away from it for all the reasons.
Too many of them in my family. I can't join your crusade, sorry.
Okay, but they're there to the idea, I'm going to heal you. I'm going to fix you till the very end. And when they finally realize they can't, it's uncomfortable. They don't want to be around you. And they don't want to take the time. And they don't want to get caught in the emotion. You're just a case and all this other stuff.
It's a generalization, Paul, but to a general extent, there's a definite difference between what service or support that a physician can provide and what a social worker
can. One of the things that often frustrates me with physicians who might say, you know what, there's nothing more we can do. I want you to know that is the most offensive thing that a physician could say to people who do this work. We work our butts off providing really phenomenal care.
Till the last breath, to
the last minute. I had a conversation with a physician years ago who was somewhat frustrated with me, and I said, you know something, doctor? I said, I've seen more death than you ever will in your lifetime. And he said, what do you mean? I'm a physician. And I said, you know something? I said, let's just be clear. I said, I'm at the bedside holding that person's hand,
mm-hmm.
comforting that family. You get a phone call
mm-hmm.
that they've died.
Yes.
That is typically...
And you're signing a certificate. Right.
Exactly. And that doesn't mean to diminish their value.
No.
It just says we all have our roles. And my role is one to be present and to be a witness and to reflect back what I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to end this conversation because we're at the end of
I'm going to quote, and it's not your quote, it's not from your book, but it's something that is that you mention in your book, and it's credited to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross,
yes, famous
author on death and dying.
A very famous author.
And I think this is where that neutrality that we have to get into, and we try to on this show. Okay, it's not a bad thing or it's not a good thing. You say, and you quote Elizabeth saying, watching a peaceful death is like watching a falling star. Neither frightening nor painful. So part of life is this reality. And if we can put ourselves in that neutrality where it's not judging bad or good, then we really actually have a chance to maybe providing a quality of life for people as they basically, and I won't say pass, die.
Yes. How do people get in touch with you, Mike? We got a 30 seconds.
Oh, gosh. You can reach us online at 247CAH.com. You can call me directly, 714-489-3337. I'm happy to talk to anybody.
Right. And if anybody's interested in Michael's book, reach out to me, 949-492-1872 or 949-212-8299 or by email at Gmail. Let me know, and we'll make that happen. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.